Penelope. "We don't know where you come from," says the woman, the mother, absently. "Yeah," adds the man, the father, "we found you." They glance across the table at each other. They might have smiled, she isn't sure. She considers the possibility that they're joking, that it's just a joke, but decides against it. They're not generally clever that way. The fact that the boy, the brother, is laughing proves nothing. He is a certified cretin, mouth breather, slow blinker, C-minus student, bully of ants and tadpoles. Besides, what they say makes perfect sense and only confirms what she has long suspected. They turn their attention back to their dinner, as if that were the end of it. She lays her fork on her plate without making a sound. "Where?" she asks. They choose to ignore her, focusing instead on the pipeline between plate and mouth. Fine. Having long since cataloged their tendencies, she waits them out, perfectly still. Eventually, the father turns and looks at her. "Where what?" he asks between lumpy swallows. "Where did you find me?" They glance at each other again, a hint of uncertainty clouding their normally vacant expressions. She shakes her head and sighs, amazed by the magnitude of their simplicity. She is 7. She's a fair deal smarter than the brother, who is 12. She is also smarter than the mother and the father, though they seem unaware of this fact. She has read enough books to know that 7-year-old girls are more than capable of solving mysteries, of turning the tables on their adversaries and would-be tormentors, of striking out alone and making their own way. Enough to know that families are quite often ill-intentioned, if not downright villainous, where their daughters are concerned. That, one way or another, daughters can expect to bear the lion's share of familial animus. Above all, she knows that the most likely explanation for her difference from them lies in the fact that she is not actually one of them. They have dropped hints to this effect often enough. Now they've finally slipped up and taken it too far, unwittingly revealing a glimpse of her true origin. The mother shrugs as if the matter were no concern of hers. Without looking up, she says, "By the side of the road." "Yeah," the father seconds again, "we found you by the side of the road." No mistaking it this time. Mischievous looks, self-satisfied smiles. She nods. "Which one?" "Eat your food, Penelope," the mother says through closed teeth. She hazards a glance at the table in front of her. Thick slices of gristly ham, a mushy pile of canned peas, a small glass of goat's milk. This is not dinner, not something she would ever choose for herself. It is an ambush, a punishment in search of a crime. Ignoring the mother, she looks across the table at the father. With satisfaction, she notes the onset of the familiar agitated twitching of his right eyelid. She waits. The waiting, and even more the control it implies, begins to rankle. "What?" She says nothing, simply continues staring. Now the corner of his mouth is twitching too. His limit reached, the hammer falls. 78, he bellows, a glistening particle of fat flying from his mouth and landing in his beer. "Highway 78, that's where we found you, right off the shoulder in some shrubs between the highway and the creek." He pronounces it, crick. "Yeah," the brother chimes in, his cheeks bulging with food. "By the crick, that's where you're from. You came from out of the crick, with the frogs and all that green, slimy stuff." Fixing the brother with an icy stare he is unable to return, she thinks, better to live with the frogs than with the toads. She looks at each of them in turn, studying their blank, stolid faces while they do their best to ignore her. Taking her napkin from her lap and folding it neatly, she places it beside her plate. Pushing her chair back from the table, she stands up and excuses herself, which is not the custom. The custom, of course, is to ask to be excused, a request typically denied on the grounds of one or another trivial infraction, most often that of not properly cleaning her plate. That her plate, in this instance, has not been touched, that it still contains the glutton's portion of ham and peas doled out by the father, only heightens the sense of mutiny. In the interval of disbelief carved out by this brazen display of insubordination, she leaves the kitchen. Crossing the hall into the small living room, she walks over to the Baldwin combo organ, a preposterous piece of musical furniture that no more belongs in this artless house than a Bösendorfer or a Stradivarius. Acquired upon the death of the mother's uncle, its presence can be attributed to the father's belief that it is worth something. The only one in the house capable of playing it, she is naturally forbidden from so much as touching it. Pulling the matte plastic cover from the organ and tossing it aside with a flourish, she sits down before the instrument. Switching it on, she turns the volume knob to high, then activates the bass and clarinet tabs. Scooting the three-legged stool back to a virtuoso's remove from the keyboard, she flexes her fingers ostentatiously. Assuming a pose of exaggerated concentration, she launches into a furious, atonal rendition of Fior Elisa to the accompaniment of an up-tempo bossa nova beat. The reaction to this provocation is immediate. Leaping as one from the table, the mother and the father fly across the hall into the living room. The mother grabs her by the elbow and yanks her from the stool, while the father fumbles with the still wheezing organ, eventually managing to reset the tabs and turn it off. As the mother leads her away by the flesh of her upper arm, she cranes her neck in order to watch the father wrestle with the plastic cover in a frantic attempt to reclothe the instrument, thereby returning it to its normal state of pristine uselessness and preserving its value. The patient extraction of information, the calculated disobedience, the seemingly impromptu musical performance. These represent events 1 to 3 in a perfectly executed sequence that is part careful plan, part improvisation, the rest of which unfolds as follows. 4. Deposited in the middle of her room, she stares down the barrel of the admonitory finger wagging in her face, smiling indulgently in response to the mother's hysterical assurances of pending retribution. The mother exits the room, slamming the door behind her. She is alone. 5. While the mother and the father, with occasional lobbying from the brother, debate at length over a suitable punishment, she slips into the brother's room, taking his folding camp knife and his all but unused canvas rucksack. 6. Pulling a cardboard box from the back of her closet, she transfers the items in it, flashlight, Boda bag, black licorice, chewable vitamins, roll of duct tape, to the rucksack, along with the knife, a change of clothing and a rain poncho, a pair of galoshes, her sketchbook and box of pencils, and her Jules Verne omnibus. 7. Climbing out of her bedroom window, she makes her way along the side of the house to the garage, where she fills the wineskin with water and grabs a map from the glove box of the father's pickup. After letting the air out of the truck's tires, she hoists the rucksack onto her shoulders and pedals away from the house on her rusty bicycle. 8. Leaving her bicycle by the entrance to the playground at the end of the street, she backtracks toward and past her house. Working her way through the neighboring yards, she hops one wooden fence after the other, acknowledging the occasional forgotten dog with a comradely salute, and collecting fruit, apricots, plums, lemons, pomegranates, from untended trees as she goes. 9. After a kilometer or so of fence hopping, she rests beneath a persimmon tree, eating a few pieces of licorice and drinking some water. She consults the map, which indicates the presence, just a few blocks away, of a tributary of the main creek, i.e. Crick, which is not an actual creek, but rather a concrete culvert designed to carry runoff from the infrequent rains to the coast. Following this tributary north will take her directly to the culvert itself. From there, she has only to walk along the culvert's paved bed for a few kilometers to reach the point where it begins to parallel the highway. 10. After watching the setting sun fade from orange to pink to red, she sets off for the tributary. Once there, she changes into her galoshes and walks along the middle of the shallow stream. When darkness falls, she takes out her flashlight, navigating by way of the light it sends sparkling across the water's surface. By the time she reaches the culvert, a full moon sits low in the sky and she no longer needs the flashlight. She locates a column of steel rungs set into the side of the culvert and climbs down to the bottom. The water flowing along the culvert is scarcely wider or deeper than it was in the tributary. In places, it dwindles to a mere trickle, its meandering edge bordered by tufts of soft green algae. The moon slips behind a cloud, and for a moment, all is dark. Crickets chirp. Unseen frogs peep and croak. Somehow, she knows she does not come from here, from this damp, amphibious place. More likely, it seems to her, she drifted in from somewhere out on the sea beyond. The cloud passes and the culvert is once again bathed in moonlight. Its concrete walls glowing soft and white, the imposing earthwork assumes the appearance of an illuminated tunnel, pointed in the direction of her destiny, which is also her origin. A magic walkway, she thinks. Tightening the straps of her pack and humming a tune of her own invention, she follows it. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.